Hi, Mary.
Maeve, I have brought you a present.
You did?
I got these from the mother of the organiser of the last meeting, which was philanthropy on climate justice.
What? What are they?
Oh, my God. I think very St. Patrick's Day biscuits.
Wait, an adult made these?
Be careful now.
Mary, look how pretty.
Yes,
shamrocks.
Indeed. As a special present.
See, this is what happens when you've been president. People just give you homemade biscuits.
I want people to give me biscuits, so all I have to do is become president.
Exactly.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mothers of Invention.
Yes, you're so welcome. That was Mary Robinson, first female president of Ireland, who has continued from there to be an overachiever, first at the United Nations and today championing climate justice around the world.
And that's Maeve Higgins. She's an Irish writer, as I think you know by now, and a comedian who has followed in the footsteps of many of our fellow citizens over the centuries, of our coming up to Patrick's Day, don't forget, to make her home here in New York, where they really celebrate Patrick's Day and where she's making quite an impression.
You know, all I do on St. Patrick's Day is hide in the house. I have to get out there. I want to be invited. I know, you're shaking your head. Together, we're the hosts of Mothers of Invention, introducing our listeners to the inspirational women who are working on new and innovative ways to understand and address climate change all over the world and hear their genuinely incredible stories.
This week, we're asking quite a specific question and we're focusing on just one country. We want to know if American public opinion is changing and if it is changing fast enough. We're focusing just on America because, as the world's largest economy, it's still ahead of China, but that might change, it has a tremendous significance for us all, wherever we are from and wherever we're going.
So in studio with us today, I'm so glad to have you, Rihanna. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. I'm Rihanna Gunn-Wright. I'm the policy lead for the Green New Deal at New Consensus, which is one of the main policy shops working on the Green New Deal. It's such an honor to be here with both of you.
An honor?
It is!
I know that you've been involved as one of the architects of the Green New Deal, which we've all heard a bit about but need to know more about.
The Green New Deal aims to eliminate the U.S. carbon footprint by 2030. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey announced the resolution on Capitol Hill with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
All great American programs, everything from the Great Society to the New Deal, started with a vision for our future.
And really, the whole Green New Deal is about saying, we're about to transition our whole economy. How do we do it justly so that everyone can participate and benefit? Especially in the U.S., we have a history of certain groups benefiting more than other groups. So New Consensus was formed essentially because there were these progressive candidates coming out of organizations like Justice Democrats, right? Representative Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, mm-hmm. Representative Ilhan Omar, who were running on these big ideas and they needed to flesh them out. But they were going to other think tanks to talk about them, particularly the Green New Deal, and no one wanted to take it up because they said it was too radical, it wasn't politically feasible, there was no point in working on it, essentially. And so a couple of founders of Justice Democrats founded New Consensus to basically be a policy shop that would just try to focus on solutions and go all the way on these big progressive policies and try to turn them into legislation.
It's so interesting. I was reading about, like, there was like one weekend where people from New Consensus, the Sunrise Movement, and Justice Democrats kind of sat around and made a Google document and were like, okay, what is this? The Green New Deal? Like, what's it going to be?
And then New Consensus did a lot of the policy work to figure out what exactly is needed to decarbonize an economy seriously across all sectors, and then what social policies need to be in place to support that transition. Because tackling climate change on the scale that we have to is going to transform the entire economy. And that can shake up a lot of people's lives for good and for bad.
I think that's a very, very good point. And just one concern, so let me voice it now.
Yeah.
I mean, the Green New Deal has got a lot of impact in Europe as well. People are really interested. And is there a danger that it will be politicized or over-politicized? We don't want this to become a divisive issue in a party political sense. It's far too important. We want both Democrats and Republicans, with their different policy approaches, to really embrace the need to address climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we've seen the opposite.
Good.
So I think it was a couple things. The first thing is that some Republicans are looking for ways to separate themselves from Trump, and they've decided that climate change is one of the issues
good,
that they want to
right.
move on.
If they want to attract young people,
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And so now we've been hearing that Republicans are like, what are we going to put on the table?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's our version of the Green New Deal?
Mm-hmm.
Because other than saying no, you have to eventually say yes to something. And so we've actually been hearing that it's generating.
So you think there will be
generating
a kind of Republican version, whether it's called Green New Deal or not.
Yeah. I think there will be something, because otherwise I think they're savvy enough to realize that they're seeding an issue and they can only deny it for so long, especially as the electorate is becoming more polarized.
So can you tell us about your journey into this climate work?
Yeah, so I started off, my background is in social policy entirely. I've worked in different areas. I worked in higher ed a lot. I've worked in health policy some. I've worked in criminal justice policy.
You're so young.
Yeah, I'm just a nerd, so.
I know that you've been a Rhodes Scholar. And you're like a brilliant mind. So that's probably why you've achieved all of this in such a short time.
Well, yeah, and it was just like I kept moving jobs that required me to work on other policy.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't actually go deep in the climate until I started the Green New Deal. I had worked on some environmental justice issues in Detroit. So like in Detroit, we have an incinerator that sits in the middle of the city. 80% of the trash it burns is from neighboring suburbs. Mm-hmm. And so I worked on those from a health perspective. But as far as going deep on climate climate change, I hadn't. And if I'm being honest, it's because it felt like a very white issue to me.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. I mean, my whole career, I've been focused on poverty and equity and trying to figure out intersectional solutions to these problems. And the people that I'm trying to center in my policy, climate change just doesn't, unless they are frontline communities, mm-hmm. like really frontline, it doesn't rank high on their list of existential crises. We're talking about people who are trying to figure out how to feed their families.
Mm. Right.
People have very precarious labor situations, don't have child care.
I know what you mean, though. No matter how devastating the bigger picture is, if you're just trying to get through the day, it's hard to focus on it.
Yeah.
And yet there is an impact now of the Green New Deal. Is America ready for it?
I mean, the polling says yes.
Yeah, well, according to this study that the Yale Program for Climate Change Communications did, the Green New Deal has quite strong support, you know. 81% of registered voters saying that they either strongly support, 40% say they strongly support it, or somewhat support this plan.
Which for an issue that came out 3 months ago, pretty phenomenal. And I think the other really important thing to remember about the Green New Deal is there's actually bipartisan support. So Republican folks in power don't like it, but their base is polling above 50%.
Uh-huh.
And Democrats are polling like 92%. So people ask why you connect like economic justice and climate change. And the truth is that we're just taking the economic transformation that is going to come from moving away from fossil fuel seriously. Because if you change your energy source, you change everything.
So it's quite a holistic approach. But my understanding is you haven't built in a climate tax or a climate, you know, charge.
Yeah, that's because the policy details are still being worked out. And that's purposeful. So in the resolution, if you see, there's a couple places where they say, we say very specifically that this is going to be a democratic and participatory process because too many people are going to be affected to try to make the policy in some closed room with just
really
experts. Yeah. And so we've slowed down because saying details right now is really, honestly, that's about us seeming serious to other people in power. But what's actually more serious is listening to people whose lives will be affected by the choices that we're trying to make and really trying to understand, okay, when we say we're going to do X, what does that mean for you? And trying to really think about I call them second order effects, because we're in a system. If you change one thing, you change something else. There's a knock-on effect. And so we are just taking the space. So a price on carbon is not off the table, right? It's still an open question, but we're trying to.
We saw in France where an increase in the fuel tax there, because it was done the wrong way.
Exactly.
And because it was done by a president who had removed wealth tax, it was perceived to be more on the side of the rich. And it's led to a lot of social disharmony and,
absolutely,
you know, and disruption.
Because often I think we're asking the same people who have put their bodies and lives on the line willingly or unwillingly to allow us to have fossil fuels to then turn around and make the transition on their backs again, which is unacceptable.
I mean, have you given a lot of thought to the need for just transition of those workers?
Absolutely. Mm. We think about that. And actually, we define just transition pretty broadly.
Good.
Because a lot of people think just about coal miners or folks who directly work in fossil fuel industries. But in fact, like we said, this is an economic transformation that will ripple out. So for instance, I'm in Detroit. The auto industry, when you change to electric vehicles, the entire supply chain changes because electric vehicles have far fewer parts than internal combustion engines. So what does a just transition mean for those workers? And how are you managing automation for those farmers that we're talking about changing agricultural practices, right? And so we're trying to think about just transitions broadly.
Climate wasn't a big issue in the 2016 election.
Yeah.
Do you see it, climate, becoming like an election swinging issue this time?
100%. Someone asked Kamala Harris today if we could pay for it. She said, of course we can pay for it. Right. So it is becoming a bit of a line in the sand because people, I think, especially regular Americans, understand it's about climate, but it's also about a vision for our economy. And it's about how do we want to, in this next stage of our country after fossil fuels, how do we want to renegotiate and think about the power relationships between everyday folks, people in power? Whether it's
and do you think people are ready, particularly here in the United States, to understand that we can't have an economy that's based on growth and consumption together?
I think
consume for the benefit of the economy.
I think some people are understanding it, and conversations around the Green New Deal, we are trying to push that because one of the biggest projects is redoing all buildings for energy efficiency, right? And we understand that it's not just changing energy sources, it's also trying to reduce how much we consume so that we don't get to this point again.
Yeah.
Since we last saw each other, Mary, there was quite an exciting event happened here in New York that taught me all of these regular people on the ground who are kind of coming together to say, like, stop this growth. It can't keep going. We have to, like, check ourselves. And that was Extinction Rebellion. Do you remember?
Oh, yes. Yes, they were in London. Are they here now in New York?
Yeah. So Mary got held up on a bridge before because Extinction Rebellion were doing an action there. And she was, like, delighted with that. But I went to see their action in New York. And
To see it, Maeve, or to be more involved? I mean, were you half brave or were you brave?
I didn't get arrested. I said to her, like, the last time, I was like, I don't want to get arrested because I'm an immigrant. And she was like, oh, you're not brave, Maeve. You're like half brave, Maeve.
You want your co-host to get deported?
She wants me to get deported.
Those are problems that former presidents don't have to worry about.
I don't think so. Call it, I don't get this diplomatic immunity.
Listen, she has a go at me a lot. Don't worry.
So take a little listen about how I got along at the Extinction Rebellion thing. So we're here, we're standing between like the Plaza Hotel and the Apple Store in a very swanky part of the city. It's so cold. I hope, Mary, that you appreciate this. Hi. We're making a climate justice podcast. It's called Mothers of Invention. My name is Maeve.
Well, I'm old school. So okay. To the older ones, I'm sister. And to the younger ones, I'm Aunt Shirley from the Forgotten Borough, Staten Island.
Can you, like, describe what's happening today?
Well, it's about the climate, but for me, it's about everything that sucks in this good old U.S. of A., okay? And we need to care about not only each other, but our environment. And if we don't do anything about it, we're not going to have an environment to do anything about. This system, it's not broken. It's working exactly how it was meant to work. And so we need to change it.
Can you tell us what your flag says?
My flag says Veterans for Peace.
Can you tell us what you're doing here today?
I'm here for humanity's sake, to try and get people to understand something's got to be done here. These politicians aren't doing it. It's a dear friend of mine, Lydia. She's with the
Granny Peace Brigade.
The Granny Peace Brigade. Oh, yeah. I see. Oh, that's so lovely.
Yeah. I'm one of the culprits in it. We're stirring up trouble.
Mary, you would love this. Everybody here is so on your wavelength. What is it? What are the goals of Extinction Rebellion?
I think that one of the overriding goals is just to make people realize how urgent action is, because we don't have 12 years to start thinking about this. We've had 50 years and done nothing. And the idea that we're just going to keep on talking and not doing anything, I think, is really shown that it's going to come to an end and we're going to pay the price for that inaction.
Hi. Okay, for the people who can't see me, which is everybody, I am a middle-aged black woman with a very large red volume of hair on my head and a tambourine and a whistle and a red coat because we are in a state of red alert.
I'm Rory Verado. I'm a PhD student at Columbia University, and I am on the media team for Extinction Rebellion New York City. I study human extinction, so that's how I got interested in this at all. And I speak often about the topic, and so I'm very comfortable speaking about it. That's really it.
Like even at parties?
Yeah, especially at parties.
What's your name? Where did you come from?
My name is Haley. I'm from Missouri, but I'm going to college here in New York, so...
I'm Yasmin. I live in New Jersey, but I just go to high school in Brooklyn. So.
Are you friends?
Yeah, we actually met at the first meeting for this, like the informational meeting. We really want to like get more young people involved because, I mean, we are the future, I feel, and it's up to us.
I think that a lot of the problems were like created by like people older than us, you know, and it's like kind of up to us to solve that.
Have you come here today prepared for direct action, like to get arrested if needs be?
This is both of our like first times. We're kind of like,
I do want to, like, at some point.
Definitely, yes. Yeah.
What do we want?
Climate justice!
What do we want? It?
Now!
What do we want?
Climate justice!
What do we want? It?
Now!
If we don't get it!
Shut it down!
If we don't get it!
Shut it down!
If we don't get it!
Shut it down!
Well, Maeve, I take it all back. I'm very glad that you went and that you were brave enough to have all those interviews. No, they do give you a sense, and I love it seemed a very young voice saying, you know, we are the future and we need to take action, etc. It's really encouraging to see young people, you know, really giving that leadership.
Earlier today, there was like over 100 young people outside of Mitch McConnell's office. They did a sit-in. Oh. I think it was like maybe 200 of them. They're not playing. I don't understand. Sunrise Movement is not playing.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, there was a sense of fearlessness around the climate extinction event that I was like, God, this is exciting.
Yeah, I think people underestimate how well everyday folks, far more than people in power, understand that we live in a system and that climate change has to be addressed by systemic changes. I've had so many conversations about how do we deal with climate change in the most cost-effective way. We can't deal with justice at the same time. And I'm like, go out on these streets and tell people. I don't think anyone was like, I just want you to deal with climate. I'm looking for the cheapest solution.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't, as long as the country doesn't go bankrupt, people want it to change and they want to feel like the next version of the country is going to include them.
So now it's time to get some more insight into changing public opinion.
Jennifer Marlin is a research scientist at the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. Welcome, Jennifer.
Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you so much. Good. I love what you're doing here.
So I truly welcome the work of the Yale Center. Your focus, and I'm reading here from your website, is to conduct scientific research on public climate change knowledge, attitudes, policy preferences, and behavior, and the underlying psychological, cultural, and political factors that influence them. And
is that your Tinder bio?
Oh, dear.
I'm interested that you yourself didn't start out in communications.
No. Yeah, so my training is in geography, and I started by studying the mud that you find at the bottom of lakes.
Really?
Yeah. So I actually started my studies by doing lake cores. This is when you go out to a lake and you basically take a big pipe and you sink it down into the, you know, muck, and you can pull up the sediments and you can actually study the mud and reconstruct past climate changes. This discovery process just made me a kind of just shocked at how quickly the climate system can really kind of flip. And that just made me very motivated to keep studying. And then eventually I moved more towards the social sciences because I realized that we know everything we need to know in many regards in terms of the physical science. It's really a social problem now.
It's so interesting that what you're studying is people who are so messy and complex.
The physical sciences, some people think, oh, that's the hard science. No, I would disagree. I think studying people is the hard science.
Tell us, though, how this research is conducted, Jennifer. Mm-hmm.
So most of our research is conducted by using surveys, nationally representative surveys. And we focus on the American public because we emit a lot of carbon in the U.S. But we've also done surveys in China and India and some other places, but it's primarily in the U.S. And it's primarily to just ask people about their attitudes, their beliefs, what they fear or don't fear about climate change and what they're willing to do or not do for it. We make sure that we have people of different education levels and age groups and so on.
Yeah, I imagine it to be like, you know, the bus in Speed, that film where they like have one of every type of person.
Exactly. We want to be representative so that we know what when we say American adults on average, we really mean all American adults.
Yeah.
One of our most popular studies identified six different groups in the American public based on their beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors about climate change. So we have a group called the Alarmed. And these are people who are the most worried. They support aggressive action to reduce carbon pollution. And they understand that it's burning fossil fuels that's causing the problem. But then directly opposed to the Alarmed, we have a group called the Dismissive who don't acknowledge that it's happening and, you know, oppose climate action. And then there are groups in the middle. So that's at the national level. But then when you start looking at particular states or even at county levels, you can see that the distribution of these different groups varies, you know, with people along the coasts or in the south having, you know, a different understanding and different concerns about the issue.
Something in your research that you found was that older white men tend to be kind of less bothered about climate change.
Yes.
Because it doesn't affect them as much, or?
There's something called the conservative white male effect, a characteristic of older white men, conservative white men in particular. They have much lower risk perceptions, not just of climate change. And by risk perceptions, I mean things like how much of a threat do they perceive the impacts to be, or how worried are they about it? Those older conservative white males really kind of are skewed. They're very different than almost all other racial, ethnic, or even age categories. African Americans tend to be more worried, and in part that's because they tend to be more vulnerable. They tend to live in neighborhoods and communities that are more at risk. They already suffer higher rates of asthma, for example. They're exposed to more pollution. Women tend to perceive greater risk. We see this in the climate change data. They're more likely to perceive harm to future generations, for example. We are starting to see, as you mentioned, younger Republicans being more concerned than their older counterparts.
Huh.
But two people can go through the same wildfire or the same hurricane and come out of it with completely different views of what caused that event to happen and what should be done about it. Because people filter their experiences through their ideology, through their political lenses,
yeah.
And that sticks.
And there does seem to be quite a lot of cultural change going on in a good sense here in the United States. I mean,
yeah.
The recent elections with so many women being elected, women of such diversity,
yeah.
From different parts of the country, different of color, etc., and representing indigenous peoples.
Right.
And is that now reflected in your surveys? Are you seeing more?
We are. What we're seeing is that over the past 5 years, and especially over the past year or two, people are starting to change their mind at an increasing rate. And now the Alarmed constitute 29% of the American public. which is higher than it's ever been. That's a record high. And then the dismissive and the doubtful groups on the opposite side of the spectrum have correspondingly declined. So they've dropped 5 percentage points since 2013.
And do you have thoughts on, like, how important it is to change everybody's mind? Or are you kind of at the point where it's like, no, the majority of us know, so we have to get moving? Or
yeah, I think we will never change everyone's mind, and we don't need to change everyone's mind. And in fact, a lot of people are, you know, worried and concerned in trying to change the minds of deniers or people who think it's a hoax. And to me, that's a wasted effort. Most of the American public is on board and ready to act and wants to move much faster than we are. They understand we have to do that or we're in big trouble. And in fact, all you need is a small group of very organized, motivated people.
And powerful.
And powerful. That helps for sure. Okay. I'm excited by the political momentum. I'm excited by young people.
Yes.
And I think we can do, if we get organized, if different groups get organized and energized, they can be so powerful. And people just don't understand how much power is accessible if you can take it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. The research you're doing is really important.
Thank you. Heading in the right direction. We need to speed it up.
Yeah.
Thank
absolutely.
You very much.
Okay. Great to see you, Jennifer.
Any reaction? What was the first thing that you thought of?
I just thought it was so interesting because in all of the conversations about climate change I've been having, it always comes back to the real barrier is people, not actually the climate, right? How many times have you like really screwed something up, don't know how to fix it, and you're just like, I'm gonna back away slowly and hope that this fixes itself.
It's like, so human, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't that like the whole phenomenon of ghosting? Aren't we just trying to ghost the planet? In our response to climate change, except now we figured out that, like, you can't leave.
Yeah, that it's actually the best relationship that we're ever going to have.
We tried to date the moon and Mars, and, like, so far we have not been successful. And so now everyone's like,
Actually, I really like you.
Yeah. Can we make it work?
What do you think when she talked about, like, people filtering their experience through their own ideology?
So I'm fairly new to the climate fight. And before I got involved, I used to think, if it gets bad enough, like if there are enough weather emergencies, obviously people will see that this is an issue. But that is not what I've seen. I mean, I'm a Christian and I've definitely even heard in our own communities, oh, this is just like the coming judgment.
I liked when Jennifer said, most of the U.S. public is on board, right?
100%.
She's like over the whole deniers. They don't matter.
Yeah.
She said most of the U.S. public is on board and ready to act.
Yeah.
Is that your experience?
I was just looking at some statistics that resonated with what I found, which is that like people of color are more willing to deal with climate than almost any other group. There was like 85% of African Americans were like, we should take action on climate. But these are also folks who are often trying to figure out how to live, right? Trying to figure out how to get childcare. So what is immediately frightening for them is not necessarily climate change. But yeah, I totally have seen so many people interested and motivated about climate change more than I expected when I got in this fight.
Well, our next guest knows all about the challenges of moving the needle with communities who have traditionally been slower to engage with the climate crisis. Anna Jane Joyner is going to join us by phone from Alabama. She's been a committed Christian climate activist for over a decade after writing her university thesis on biblical scriptures that address the moral reasons to care for the environment. So be on your best behaviour now.
I'm blessing myself.
I'm here.
Hi, Anna Jane. Thank you so much for taking our call. It's Maeve here. I'm in the studio with Mary Robinson and with Rihanna Gunn-Wright. Rihanna,
yes,
you want to say
hi? I follow you on Twitter.
Oh my God! Hello, boo! Hello, sweet baby angel. How are you?
So I love that like social media can do this, right? You guys are both working towards similar goals, it's fair to say, in very different parts of the country. Can you tell us, Anna Jane, where we're finding you today and what you're up to?
Yes, I am sitting in my little cottage on the sea in Alabama. My family has been here for 6 generations. So I moved actually down from New York City about 2 years ago to be here full time. A lot of people don't even know that Alabama has a beach, but it's really beautiful.
Oh, good. I'm glad you said that because I was just feeling so ignorant sitting here. I was like, she's sitting by the sea in Alabama. Anna Jane, you've had a really like inspired but quite a challenging journey into climate work. Is that fair to say? Could you give our listeners?
Yeah, so I was raised in kind of a very intense evangelical community. My dad is what some would call a megachurch pastor. And we were actually raised in North Carolina and spent the summers down here in Alabama. So environmentalism and all of those things were kind of very taboo subjects. We were, you know, proud Republicans and conservatives. I wasn't raised with, you know, kind of a lens of caring for the earth. But I was raised in these beautiful places. So I do think that my parents did a good job of kind of seeding in me a love of nature, for sure. Mm-hmm.
So given your upbringing and all the experiences that you've had now, why do you think Christians in the U.S. have tended to be conservative on climate?
I mean, it's pure. I don't like to use the word tribalism because I think it's pure like partisan politics, basically. It's kind of my team versus your team at this point. And unfortunately, climate change just got caught up in that. It's interesting, like my father, who's probably as conservative as you can imagine, like was on Trump's transition team. He actually will come around to some environmental issues. He actually doesn't like burning coal in general because of all of the pollution that it causes. I mean, I think he sincerely believes that like we're called to be good stewards of the earth, but climate change, unfortunately, has just been so pigeonholed as a liberal issue that it's just, you know, it's like a sports team. It's like my team doesn't do that, yours does. And there's just very little moving him on that and many of his kind of constituents.
So I'm so interested that you went to your dad, which must not have been easy, and like used your own experience. Like, was it effective?
There was definitely some common ground. I mean, he's let me give sermons at his church before around caring for the environment. He really sincerely believes that we should care for the earth. It's unfortunately just climate change that's, you know, because it's so wrapped up in partisan politics and our country is so divided right now that he just can't move past that. And I've had to, you know, I've had to kind of let it go. Like, of course, I still try. But I think, you know, I think that strategically speaking, the amount of people who are in that kind of very entrenched denier space is pretty small. It's really more worth our time and energy to be focusing on helping people who already care know what to do. Where you find that that's different is as you get into younger generations, a lot of even people who are raised evangelical and even who still attend those kinds of churches, as you get younger, they're more and more open to climate change. And I've done quite a bit of work with that community and there's a lot more hope there.
Yeah. I'm so interested in the word stewardship too.
Yeah. I'm really interested, Anna, because I am a Christian and stewardship, as you know, I mean, it's a big topic for us. I was raised Pentecostal too, which I think technically is evangelical.
Yes, so you know.
Yeah.
My dad is Pentecostal.
Yeah. Oh, okay. But I've only really ever heard about financial stewardship, right? And I hadn't really heard of folks connecting the concept of stewardship to the earth, at least in the churches I went. So how has that been going for you?
I would say that's largely true for me as well. Like growing up in a charismatic Pentecostal church, you didn't hear much about caring for the earth at all. You know, it was very focused on the afterlife or this other spiritual realm. There was very little about taking care of us here and now. So after I kind of had my epiphany around environmental justice and wanting to work on this issue, I ended up studying that kind of intersection of communication and caring for the earth. And one of the first things you learn when you're studying communication is like you have to really know your audience in order to persuade them. And so I read the Bible and I started studying all of these amazing Christian teachers, both who are living now and historically. And there's all of this really rich tradition within Christianity around caring for the earth. And so I wrote my senior thesis on evangelical environmental discourse. And it was kind of laying out some of the reasons that historically evangelicals haven't been concerned about the environment, but also within their own text of the Bible and that tradition, they really should, because the first commandment in the Bible is to steward the earth.
Rihanna is nodding her head here, and I'm having like slight memories of like growing up in the Catholic Church where there was like St. Francis who loved, you know, animals and nature.
Well, and Pope Francis is great on climate change.
In fact, Jennifer Marlin, who we are hearing from in this episode as well, said that when he says something about climate, people really pay attention, you know, like he's like an influencer. So wait, Anna Jane, is this right? You describe yourself as a politically progressive Episcopalian?
Yes, that would be correct. I've been going to Episcopalian churches for like 8 years now, so I feel like I can claim it. My journey with Christianity and religion and spirituality has been complex. Like when I moved down here to Alabama, I wrote the bishop and was like, I need a church that, you know, is affirming to gay people and takes climate change seriously. And they were like, okay, here are the two that we recommend.
Wait, you can do that?
Yeah.
I have not gone to church for 2 years for that exact same reason. I was like, I'm tired of getting involved in these communities. And then it's like, psych, gay people are welcome. And I'm like, oh, great, gotta go. But that's such an interesting response. Do you think like faith communities taking more progressive stances helps?
I do. And I actually think that, like, you know, especially in the United States, we tend to kind of emphasize, like, you know, people like my dad, like right-wing evangelicals, because they're more vocal. They've also kind of created a political monopoly around the Republican Party.
Yeah, they have more power. I wish we were more honest about that. Like, if climate change deniers were poor Black people, we wouldn't care about moving them.
Not try and pander to them.
No. We wouldn't build a whole strategy around appealing to their responses. That's been our strategy with the Green New Deal. Because the Republican Party for so long has just sort of denied climate change. And so how do you meet in the middle when the other side has nothing?
Isn't even on the road.
It is, but I think that this new moment that we're in, largely thanks to your work on the Green New Deal and all these amazing young activists, it does feel like for the first time we're providing policy solutions and visions, really, that match the problem. The solutions never felt like they matched the crisis for those of us who are concerned. And now I feel like that's beginning to change because we're getting more bold.
Yeah.
And I thank you for your work on that. I'm so appreciative.
No, you're welcome. I mean, I'll die in the ball of fire too. So, it's, you know, it's not like there's no self-interest involved.
But these progressive faith communities, they're actually, there's a lot of them. Maybe they're quieter and they're not as, you know, they're not as much in the political space, but I do think it's a powerful organizing force. For one, it's like already organized communities who do generally already care about climate change and other.
And really good at baking.
Yeah.
So good at baking.
All the snacks for the movement.
Yes. Yeah. And also, I think one thing that draws me to working with faith communities is we need these kind of mythologies, if you will. You know, like within Christianity, I love the story of renewal and resurrection, or kind of like overcoming death and facing incredible darkness and getting back up. You know, like that's a powerful story because it provides a context for giving us meaning in our lives. And I do think that the climate movement has been lacking in those powerful stories that really motivate people and mobilize people.
Right.
So I think there's definitely a pretty like amazing overlap and connection when done right, for sure.
Well, Anna Jane, thank you so much. It was so lovely to talk to you.
This was such a pleasure. And thanks for following me on Twitter, you sweet baby angel.
Yeah. Also, I have a podcast too. Yeah. Check it out. It's called No Place Like Home, and it's with Marianne Hitt, who's the director of the Beyond Coal campaign at the Sierra Club.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's not like specifically for a Christian audience, but we are both Christians, so we talk a lot about the intersection of spirituality and activism.
I'm definitely going to subscribe. I'm always looking for stories like that, especially being new to this.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, thank you, Anna Jane.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Okay. Y'all have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What an insightful group of mothers this week.
Thank you so much for joining us, Rihanna. It really has been great to have you as a co-host. We hope you enjoyed yourself as well. And we really wish you well with the Green New Deal and with all your excellent policy work. You're pretty formidable.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, I'm going to clip that and send it to all of my trolls on Twitter when they're like, can you talk about climate change? I'm going to be like, well, the former president of Ireland said I can. Who are you? So thank you, Mary.
You don't need me to validate. You're there.
You would be surprised.
If you'd like to learn more about Rihanna, about Jennifer and Anna Jane, or any of our past mothers, you can head to our website, www.mothersofinvention.online, to find out how to support their work.
Yeah, that's right. And we are also very interested to know what you, our listeners, would like to hear more about. We have asked for and received lots of great suggestions on our social media feeds for women who should be recognised as Mothers of Invention. So you can nominate somebody. You can do it today. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Mothers Invent.
Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society, and it's made possible by the generous support of our partners, the Climate Justice Resilience Fund, the Compton Foundation, the Wallace Global Fund, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, and the European Climate Foundation, and of course, our loyal DRIP crowdfunders.
Our series producer is Thamali Kodikara. The executive producers are Jess Search and Beedi Finzi. Our audio producer and sound wizard is Anne Pope, and Jade Asante is our ace researcher. Reva Goldberg produced my Adventures at the Extinction Rebellion Rally, and Aisha Yunus is our social media magician. Our climate expert consultants are Suzanne Dhaliwal, Iris Andrews, Ed King and Catherine Wilkinson. Our theme music is Water Fountain by Toon Yards, with kind permission from 4AD and Marriage Records.